I am come home. Sorry about that, folks. I just realized I pushed the wrong button. It's Brian, of course. This is Woodwose Radio. Thanks for joining us on our Wednesday night show. We changed the schedule because it worked better for both of us. You can tell I'm not sounding up to snuff right now. So I'm going to try to keep my voice and talking to a minimum right, like tonight, but you're kind of used to that already.
Yeah, so. I do most of the talking anyway, so it's not no big thing for me. I do want to mention that if you hear me scream at Kumiko or at Boots, those are my cats, and they are being uncommonly affectionate tonight, and so they're crawling all over me. So, hi, welcome to the show tonight. We're going to be dealing this evening with the Wheel of Fortune and the Hermit, and also the Fives of the Minor Arcana. So I guess we should just go ahead and get into it. We've been using the Robin Wood deck, at least I have been, for most of the commentary. So when I talk about the imagery on this, understand that, you know, each artist has their own different imagery that they put on the cards. Where possible, I do try to talk about the imagery that is in all the cards, and I do have a number of different decks in this program that I can page through to look at the different imagery. So if my digression here has given you enough time to pull those cards out so that you can look at them, we're going to start talking about the Hermit first. The Hermit is one of those cards that I really enjoy. He reminds me a lot of Diogenes, who is looking for one honest man among all of them. The interesting thing is that when I looked at the big book for the Robin Wood deck, Robin made a point of pointing out that in the way she's crafted these cards, the Hermit is actually the realization of the Fool. The Fool has been going through his journey, and if you think back to what the Fool looked like, here's a young man who has all of his worldly possessions put into his backpack. He's got a staff, maybe. He's not paying attention. He's young. He's just walking along, not really paying attention to anything. Well, throughout the course of his journey through the major arcana, meeting the magician, the high priest, and the empress and emperor and everybody in between, he finally gets to the hermit, and he's metamorphosized. He's aged. He's grown in wisdom. He's grown in knowledge. He's paired his backpack from, you know, this big weighty thing that he's been carrying around all over the place to a couple of medicine pouches that are tied to his staff. And he's now carrying a light of illumination is what the lantern usually represents. And it's there so that he can not only shine the knowledge and the illumination of what he's learned, you know, on people around him, but he's pretty much at this point the guardian and the keeper of this light and of this knowledge and of this wisdom, and he's also looking for somebody to pass it on to take over from him and to continue going on in the future with it. And it's kind of an interesting metamorphosis because in a lot of ways this is, you know, Diogenes as well. Like I said, looking for, you know, one honest person to pass the secrets of the universe on to. I think that's a wonderful thing to relate that card to. In the book also, the Hermit, remember the Hermit is somebody that has pared out everything that they feel that they don't need in their life and gotten it down to the bare essentials. What's really important, what is necessary for their continued health, their continued mental well-being, and the care that they can take of their own bodies. It is a time of meditation and contemplation for you, so So that's what this card can mean when it comes up, is not necessarily a stopping, as in with the Fours, but a time where you do need to consider everything that you've learned up until now and realize that you have grown from where you were to where you are. An interesting little point is on the Robin Wood deck. She takes the same red feather that the Fool started out with and reprises that on the Hermit card as one of the things that he has to symbolize, you know, that he's still essentially the same person, just with a lot more knowledge and wisdom. Let's see. The Wheel of Fortune, if it's not too soon to go into that, the Wheel of Fortune is a very interesting card when you actually stop and consider what it's talking about. It's not luck. It's not gambling. It is cycles. It's what goes around comes around. It is the fact that this too shall pass. I mean, that the image of the triumphant hero coming into Rome with the slave walking backwards saying, this is going to pass, this is not permanent, you're going to, you know, you're on the top of the world right now, but eventually it's going to be gone. They're going to forget you tomorrow. That encapsulates the Wheel of Fortune completely. And it sounded like you wanted to say something, Brian.
No, I was just stifling a cough.
Oh, okay. All right. But that's the whole thing. It's everything comes in cycles. It doesn't matter what's going on right now in your life. You're going to be in the opposite of it eventually, and then even further down the line, you're going to be right back here again. It's life lessons in a lot of ways, but it's also an emotional roller coaster ride in that Robin mentions about this card that a friend of hers calls the bipolar card, because you're very, very up, you're very manic, you're jumping around, everything's wonderful, you're cleaning the house, and then 2 days later, you're so depressed you can't even be bothered to put clothes on today. And, you know, that happens all the time to all of us, whether we're bipolar or not. The only difference between a bipolar and a regular person is that bipolar people have a really faster cycle, and they tend to have much more extreme highs and lows. Other than that, we all go through the same cycles. We all hit the same highs. We all hit the same lows. It's a matter of degree. And it is both of these cards, something that I thought was interesting, she deliberately puts an imagery into it where it's broken up into eights. In the Hermit card, she has eight rays of light coming out of the lantern. In the Wheel of Fortune card, it's broken into eight pie slices, showing the cycle of the emotions. This is deliberate. She is intentionally pulling in the imagery of the eight sections of the year, not just the festivals, not the holidays, Luznada and Samhain and Beltania and Yule and all the ones that everybody knows, but the actual times in between those markers, because there's, you know, a whole section of life that you live between Mabon and Luznada, you know, that people don't really talk about. You hear about the Mabon celebration, you hear about the Luznada celebration, you hear about the other celebrations, but you don't really hear about the times between those celebrations. So I see the Hermit has eight rays of light, which can be the holidays, whereas the Wheel of Fortune has eight wedges showing different emotions in there, which can be the times in between those holidays. So it's something else to keep in mind, too.
Well, what I find interesting is that in the traditional depictions of the Hermit, actually, the light is usually coming off of what, you know, people tend to call the Star of David. So I suppose you're actually pretty correct and dead on about the sort of paganization of that, because I was looking at the Cosmic Tarot the other day, and I was like, yeah, this has got the Star of David, as mm-hmm. most hermits do.
Yeah, and she was mentioning that she put the what is actually in the lantern is a star. You can't look at it. You can't really see it clearly. And as I page through my other decks, the Llewellyn Tarot has a torch instead of a lantern. But, yeah, it is the Star of David and all these other decks, too, which I find interesting. Because you're talking about imagery for a deck that has the symbolism from a Christian, you know, monk that is in a something that they would probably curse were they to see it. Going through the other decks here, let's see. We've got
the Druidcraft Tarot has the guy holding a lantern, but there's no stars or rays of any kind that are like blatant.
Yeah. The Morgan Greer deck has the Star of David. And if you want to add that into it, now I don't know exactly all the symbolism that the Hebrew people associate with the Star of David, but I do know that it is seen as not only a seal, but also a light of illumination. It's kind of, I don't know, I guess the closest pagan equivalent would be Awen, the fire
yeah.
in the head of inspiration.
For sure.
So you've got that association as well. And once again, I also find it interesting that he's got it contained in a lantern, whereas it's something that can be carried around, because you are able to carry all your knowledge and thoughts and inspiration and everything around with you. And you can share it with everybody, and others can bask in its glory, if you will, simply by being around you. The Pagan Tarot, let's see, this has a lady sitting at a desk. Okay, she's surrounded by books. She's got a candle there, and that would follow with the symbolism, at least, because I don't know about you, but when I get into my library and I'm doing research, the rest of the world ceases to exist.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I become a hermit, and 3 days can pass, and I wouldn't even notice it. So then the candle with the illumination. Let's see. And
well,
the wheel... Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just thinking that the so-called Star of David in the Gnostic tradition is actually kind of a representation of the combination of like will and inspiration used toward, you know, magical purposes kind of thing. So it's kind of an applied wisdom as opposed to, you know, you're just kind of accumulating knowledge.
Yeah, for knowledge's sake. And that's getting knowledge simply to know it is it can be good, but it can also be obsessive. So always try to have a reason to be collecting your knowledge.
And I think that the reason that most of the hermits depict a lantern is kind of the idea of the symbolism of like the inner light of human beings who have sought Gnosis, because what we are is only a vessel for the light that is within us. That, you know, when someone comes to you and says namaste, they're actually acknowledging the light within you, as opposed to your physical vessel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the using that greeting, we're going to get off on one of my little pet peeves here. It's not really a huge one, but it's one that's irritating enough that I do think that since it's been touched on, I need to mention. that greeting is specific to the Hindu belief system, and that has extremely explicit meanings. And if you don't know what those meanings are, then don't be saying it. Because essentially what you are saying when you say namaste to somebody is, the divine light in me sees and acknowledges the divine light in you. We are one. And that's a really profound statement to say to somebody that you hardly know. I mean, once you get to know somebody after a while, or once you feel close to them, yeah, say it. Don't worry about it. But that's like, and this is another pet peeve, Mr. Spock going around and doing the Vulcan mind meld on every random creature that was in the series. It's very personal. It's very intimate. It is very, it's merging of two things into one so that you understand the other by understanding you. It's grokking that other person, to use to get back
yes.
to our Stranger in a Strange Land. You know, so Captain Kirk asking Spock to, you know, go up to a silica creature that's been killing people and mind meld with it. Yes, it's a way, or it's a plot device around the lack of communication. But this is, you know, more intimate than Spock marrying this thing and having sex with it. I mean, it's, you know, it's two souls becoming one. And so it's, you know, a slight pet peeve when I hear people just say namaste and, you know, walking off. And it's like, do you even have any clue what you just said to me? So anyway, okay, back onto the tarot. Sorry about that.
No worries.
Okay, talk about roller coaster rides. I'm looking at the Druidcraft deck also. Oh, one other mention. I know I mentioned it last week, but the Orphalese tarot deck program that I use has multiple different decks in it. You can download, I think, something upwards to 100 different decks. The file sharing feature on it has been disabled because his server was apparently hacked. And now the program's free, so go take a look at it. It's a wonderful program to use on your computer for doing readings. Wheel of Fortune. I find it interesting that in most of the Rider-Waite-based decks, they have angels and sphinxes and various other creatures that you would find in alchemy depicted on that card.
Well,
go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking that I was listening to a Gnostic podcast the other day, actually, and they were talking about the four creatures on the Wheel of Fortune, and apparently they relate to the four animals or beings that were on the, I want to sum it up as the throne of God kind of thing, but it was like the Ezekiel's wheel vision. And each of those beings represents, like, I mean, they're associated with the four gospels and all this kind of stuff, but
okay. That
yeah,
would make sense given Okay. Let's see. Reversed meanings. Let me find the deck that has those. Because like I said, I don't read reversed normally. So okay. Reversed for the Hermit. Hastiness, impudence, imprudence, which is different. Unreasoning caution or fear. Emotional immaturity, withdrawal from one's problems with no constructive plans. So a reversed hermit is being a hermit crab, or actually more being an ostrich. You're sticking your head in the sand, pulling the hole in after you, and not really doing anything about your situation. You're just kind of running away from it and hoping it disappears. And one of the things that I always learned is if you ignore your teeth, they will go away. That kind of sums up the reversal there, because if you ignore the problem, it will go away in the worst possible way imaginable, but it will go away eventually. It's living your life by default, which is another way I have of describing refusing to make a choice for anything, where you simply let actions dictate what happens, and it's not your actions, it's everybody else's actions. Well, when you do that, when you live your life by default, other people make decisions for you, and they're never to your advantage. They're always to somebody else's advantage. So eventually you wind up with the absolute worst decision possible.
Definitely.
You know? So that's something that you want to always avoid. It's going into a cave and trying to ignore the rest of the world. Well, unfortunately, even the most remote hermit gets visited by people seeking his advice and knowledge, so he can't ignore the world. The reversed Wheel of Fortune. You would think that a bipolar card would mean the same thing upright as it would reversed, but this is reversal of fortunes, failure, bad luck, unexpected interference. So this would be somebody spins the roulette wheel and sets the ball in motion for the regular Wheel of Fortune, but in this case, somebody has actually grabbed the ball and stuck it in a slot rather than letting it fall where it may. So that's what the reversed Wheel of Fortune would mean, is somebody interfering with the situation without having all the facts or changing things to their advantage and not yours. Let's see, what else can I say about these two? Told you about the association with the Hermit and the Fool, and I think that's pretty interesting that it kind of comes full cycle, that you go from 0 to 9, which is the entire first range of numbers, with the same person. You start off at 0 with the Fool, and then go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and all the way up to 9, and that every single card in between, from 0 to 9, all 10 of them, are people. There's not one card in that first set that is not a person. You have the magician and the high priestess and the empress and the emperor, and then the lovers, and I'm probably mangling the line here. Let's see, the fool, and then the magician, high priestess, empress, emperor, hierophant, then the lovers, then the chariot, which is a guy driving a chariot, then strength, and then you have the hermit again. You know, so you've got somebody being represented in each card. And it's only when you get to the 10th card, which is the 0 and 1 combined, that you start dealing with objects and concepts rather than a straight person or personality. So keep that in mind also. Let's see. I think that's about all I can probably say on the major arcana at this point, unless you've got something to say, Brian.
Not at this point, no.
Yeah, I think we probably got all the mystical aspects and everything.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're going to put those away and focus on the fives now. So the fives. As I said when we started this series, the minor arcana can be read across numerologically in that the cards as a set of numbers, not as a suit, can relate to each other. Last week, the fours were waiting periods. This time, the fives are uniformly negative cards, in my opinion. They can be positive aspected if they're like reversed or something, but you're dealing with negative situations or situations where you're not seeing everything, or there is trouble ahead. For instance, the Five of Pentacles has a beggar and a starving woman outside of a church. And the pentacles are all lit up in the church window, but they're outside, there's snow on the ground, he's hurt on a crutch, she's, you know, all bent over and begging for money. And, you know, that's not a good situation. Well, the Five of Swords is a young man looking back, carrying three swords at two other guys who are walking off, and he's basically going, nah, 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 nah. I got the swords, you don't have them. The Five of Cups is a guy in a big black coat, cloak, looking at three cups that have been knocked over, and all of the wine that was in them has run out, and it's all over the ground, while he's not noticing two other cups that are sitting behind him that are still fine. The Five of Wands is five guys, each with a staff, and they're having a big old fight, okay? So rarely do I see these cards where they're not negative aspected. To give y'all the thumbnails, the Five of Pentacles is mercy. The Five of Swords is na-na-na-na-na-na. I have something you don't. The Five of Cups I tend to associate with crying over spilled milk. And the Five of Wands I tend to associate with an unfulfilled struggle. Basically, they're just having a fight for fight's sake. Okay. Some decks note that one as training. I tend to see it as, you know, a fight because they can. Five brothers who, you know, one of them shoved the other, and another one got a little upset because the second brother got shoved into him. So they're all in a dog pile, you know, hitting on each other, and they still love each other, but they're, you know, yeah, I love you, but I'm still hitting you type thing.
Actually, it's interesting because I'm checking out a book that I have, and it suggests that the more positive aspects of the Five of Wands are things like male bonding, healthy competition, physical activity in sports, and, you know, being one of the guys kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, sparring just for the sake of, you know, letting off some energy, you know, mm-hmm. goofing around kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, I don't have a problem with doing that because everybody needs to do that every now and then. But when, you know, you're doing it all the time and you're doing it simply because you can, something's wrong. You know, it's one thing to let off energy that's extra. It's another thing to be doing it always, not never doing anything else. Always running. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of a Misty Lackey book called Magic's Promise. I believe it is, where the main character is thinking about his cousins, who have nothing to do, and so they're, you know, loud and they're boisterous and they're drinking and they're yelling at each other across the dinner table. They're thumping their plates and their goblets down, and he thinks, you know, they must be absolute terrors on the hunt, and I bet they are hunting every other day. You know, that's the kind of pent up useless energy that I'm talking about with the Five of Wands. Is it's doing all of this energy and using up all of this energy to no constructive purpose. Five of Cups, when we think about that, crying over spilled milk is the mnemonic that I use for this one always, because he's so focused on the three cups that he's lost that he's not paying attention to the two cups that he has. I mean, he's still got two cups. He's got some wine. Instead of going, okay, well, I still have some wine, let's pay attention to that. You know, no, he's, you know, focused on, I've just lost these three cups of wine. My life is over. You know, I might as well just go out and quit. I'm depressed now, and it's so dramatic, and everything is horrible. You know, and that's another fairly negative trait that a lot of people have, is the tendency to focus on what we've lost instead of what we have or what we still have despite everything. And it's obvious that he's, you know, all self-contained because he's in the big cloak. He is looking down at the goblets of wine that he's lost, and, you know, he's totally focused on that. If he would just step back from the situation, take a look around, he would realize that he still has some. Now, granted, it's not as much as he had before, but it's still something. And he needs to, you know, shift his focus there to make sure that he's paying attention to the things he still has. But as with any emotion, you know, it's terrible first instead of, you know, okay, let's get some perspective here and realize that there's still some out there. Let's see. Five of Swords. Card means failure caused by trickery, deceit, or degradation. Winning by unfair means. Cowardice and manipulation, slyness and chicanery. And this is essentially what this kid has done. He has won a victory over these two guys, but it's a victory tainted by him doing something dishonest to attain it. You know, and yes, he won, but was the winning really worth how he had to win?
And yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. It's a matter of, like, kind of, it's all ridicule and kind of an ego trip, like an immature kind of sportsman type attitude.
Yeah, and that really is the key to the Five of Swords. It's, you know, swords are violent anyway. Swords tend to be negative simply by their nature. And once again, you've got another combat, but it's a combat based on a lie or based on a trick. And so, you know, it's not a real victory, in my opinion. But, you know, that's up to the person that you're reading for. Sorry, been keeping cats off of various computers and things. So I'm a little out of breath, and I apologize for that.
Cats
see,
do
else?
Feel they own the world.
Oh, God. Mine seem to think that I am a guest in my own house and that they really own it. So let's see.
There's an interesting little phrase in this book, actually, about the Five of Swords. It says, your sense of ego may be preventing you from acknowledging that you have bitten off more than you can chew.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, and I think that happens a lot with people, especially nowadays, where everything is so focused on, like, self-esteem and, you know, trying to outdo everyone around you to, like, make your way in the world kind of thing. The tendency to let your ego sort of overwhelm you and kind of build you up into this self-important person who ultimately may have no talent or ability whatsoever. That's a very strong sense of what this card talks about.
Mm-hmm. My father used to call it your alligator mouth writing checks your hummingbird ass can't cash. And you know, that's pretty well encapsulates this as well. Let's see what else. There's minor symbolism. I mean, you know, he's also in a black tunic. It's got red piping for passion, which means that he let things get away from him. Robin mentions the griffin heads on the sword pommel. Those are probably important, and those are probably things that could be looked at a lot deeper. But those types of symbols are specific to the deck, and since they're not going to be in every deck, I tend not to mention them in these podcasts. simply due to the fact that, you know, it's not going to be the same in every deck. It's like
I mean, the thing is, too, that everyone might interpret Griffins differently. Sure. I mean, for some, it might, you know, bring to mind Gryffindor, you know, while for others, you know, I mean, Griffins may bring back negative memories of being a D&Der, you know, as a teenager and, you know, getting bullied and that sort of thing for it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is interesting. The Whimsical Tarot has the Five of Swords as the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Interesting. Very
interesting. Yeah, the Pied Piper is leading the children away, and that's the Five Swords. And so, because, you know, they were in their arrogance, didn't pay up, they lose something of value, their children. Interesting. That is, and that's a good representation, too. Okay, let's see what else. The Druidcraft deck, yeah, that's pretty much the same symbolism. The Hello Kitty deck is the same symbolism. Let's see.
I'm curious about the Housewives Tarot.
Oh, let's see here. We got it in here. Let me get to it.
Because we keep referring to it, and I'm just like, what is their Five of Swords going to be like?
Their Five of Swords is five scissors cutting out a paper doll dress.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Accepting your limitations and realism. Time management. Sure, you think you can do it all, but no one's perfect. You should acknowledge and accept your limitations and focus on goals that are actually within your reach. Your perfectionist nature may be working against you. Knitting baby booties and darning socks is an attainable goal. Sewing an entire wardrobe from scratch is not. All the time wasted on impossible could have been used more effectively for realistic tasks. That's a good interpretation, actually, when you stop and think about it. Maybe it's not quite as... anyway. Let's see. The Five of Wands in the Housewives Tarot is a lady with five feather dusters who is being attacked by a toaster, an iron, and a blender.
Okay.
Growth and progress give way to inevitable conflict. Five of Wands depicts a weary housewife besieged by household appliances. These domestic assailants seek to overwhelm her just when things were going her way. Cool. Okay, Five of Cups, martini glasses, three of them spilled out their contents, two are still full with olives in them, and she's pulling her hair out because she knows she's the one that's going to have to clean up the mess. Yep, crying over spilled milk. They actually mention it in that. Okay, on to Five of Pentacles. Almost every single deck I've ever seen relates the Five of Pentacles to a financial loss of some sort. Throwing yourself on the charity of others, asking for handouts.
Unemployment, depression.
Yeah, and that. Depressed because you're unemployed. unemployed because you're depressed. homelessness.
A catch-22.
Five of Pentacles is a lady in her living room. She's dropped a plate and four others are falling at the same time. So she's going to lose the whole stack. So let's see. But that one is about as straightforward a card as most decks seem to get. When you see two beggars, one missing a leg and on crutches, and an older lady who's begging for food outside of a church in the snow, you pretty much know that that's going to mean financial difficulties, problems, charity from others, things like that. One aspect that is often overlooked about this is that in one or two of these decks, there's a depiction of a door nearby that goes into this church. And what that represents is that, yes, they're out in the snow, yes, they're cold, yes, they're homeless, but if they make a little bit of an effort to go through the door, they'll be inside, they'll be warm. They may not have all of their problems solved, but they'll be better off than they were.
Yeah, definitely, and I think that's something to keep in mind when you're reading this card, is that while there is going to be that overall negative sort of feeling to it, it's a suggestion that taking even that small step to better your life is something that you can do. You know, it gives you that sense of hope as opposed to just becoming an all-consuming grief that mm-hmm. holds you back.
Oh, yeah. And once again, you know, that's that is it's another hindrance to your progress forward. You know, like the rest of the fives, arrogance that gets in the way of things, focusing so much on what you lost instead of what you have, getting stuck in a situation where you're fighting yourself, essentially. So, yeah, that focus on what you don't have and that obsession with it goes well with the Wheel of Fortune, because, I mean, everybody gets down the dumps, and there's times that you get down to the dumps that badly that you can't do anything. And, you know, the cure for that is to go, okay, I'm in the dumps right now. I'm going to give myself a day, 2 days, a week, and then that's going to be it. I'm going to have to do something to better the situation. Now, there's times when, you know, that's not going to be possible. But anytime you can encourage somebody to do more than what they have been doing, except wallowing in self-pity, and I know there's people out there that are going to be upset that I'm saying this, but I want to point out I suffer from dysthymia. It is chronic depression. Okay, I am always cycling down near the bottom of the emotional scale. Okay, so I know what I don't want to get out of bed because the life is horrible depression is like. I spent a year and a half like that and didn't move, 16 hours sleeping. So I'm talking from experience here. There are times when you just have to go, okay, that's enough. I'm not doing anything. I am simply laying here and get mad at yourself and kick your own self in the butt in order to get up and start doing something. And it's the hardest damn thing you ever want to do, but it's sometimes necessary to do that, okay, because things can get better. The Five of Pentacles in the Whimsical Tarot is represented by the story of the Ugly Duckling. Okay, five little ducks on the pond, one little white ugly duckling off on the side who doesn't realize that they're a swan and is one day going to be beautiful, okay, which is another perfect interpretation of that card. Let's go find the reversed meanings of all of these.
Reverse Five of Pentacles says a turning point may have arrived. You may be emerging from a difficult period such as bankruptcy or a spell of unemployment.
Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, and that's possibly. Lessons in charity to be learned. New courage, new interest in spiritual matters. Oh, that's interesting. The Pagan Tarot is the lady carrying her money into a bank and having to wait in line while somebody picks her purse.
Interesting. Yeah, because the Five of Pentacles in the Druidcraft Tarot is kind of weird. Like, it's this woman who's got five pentacles hanging from her cord belt, and she's kind of, I don't know, she's in a position where she's kind of like leaning against a tree and sort of crying or feeling self-pity or some such. And I mean, there's not really any indication directly of the traditional sort of poverty suggestion that most decks have.
Yeah. There is the hound and the, what is that, a chicken in the background?
It's actually, it refers to a story in in the Welsh tradition of Ceridwen and Taliesin. They're going through that shape-shifting period where Taliesin's trying to escape her, or Gwydion, I guess he was, at the time. He's going through...
he becomes Taliesin later.
Yeah, and she's transforming herself into the predator of whatever it is he transforms into so that he can catch her, or she can catch him. And it actually...
Probably where they got the story in The Sword and the Stone, the Disney animated one with Merlin and Mad Madam Mim and their wizards battle.
Undoubtedly. Personally, if you haven't seen Sword in the Stone, you have to see that.
Oh, it's cute.
Required viewing. otherwise, you can't watch or listen to Tarot talk anymore because it's just that cool. I love that movie.
The more widely studied you are in various memes and films and things like that, in general geekdom, the more of our references you will understand. Grocking.
Oh, we have crazy shit going on. We really do. It's great. And actually, if you're kind of curious to learn about Hermeticism, there's actually a song in The Sword and the Stone that I happen to love because it's just so cutesy and dorky. You've got Arthur and Merlin kind of exploring shape-shifting to get him used to different elements and different animals.
Oh, is this the one he sings in the moat?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that is so cute, too.
And it talks about basically the Hermetic principle of polarity, where everything has an opposite, but those opposites are necessary for the other to exist.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so yeah,
great.
I mean, that's a whole crazy arcane movie you really want to see if you haven't already. And you should see it again just because it's cute.
Yeah, it's lots of fun. It's something that it's not required. We're really not going to throw you off the channel so that you can't listen anymore. But it helps in... any type of movie or song or anything like that that is geared towards children, our society tends to stick a moral lesson in there with it. Unbeknownst to a lot of people and a lot of, I guess you could call them mundanes or muggles or whatever, there are a lot of magical lessons stuck in the same way. The song with the polarities in Sword and Stone is a perfect example. Okay, there was I can't think of any other examples right now. My brain is failing me. But when you start looking for them, they're there very plainly. It's just you have to know what you're looking for in order to see them.
Yeah.
And I'm
actually, Disney's really good at subliminal messaging and teaching weird occultic stuff through their movies.
There's like The Matrix. There's an overriding theme in the three Matrix movies, and that is you have the capability of, through your will, changing the reality around you. All you have to do is believe it. And that's, you know, that's the main thrust of Matrix, Matrix Revolutions, Matrix Reloaded, all three of those, the games, the short flicks, everything. And that is a powerful magical lesson to bring home.
Yeah, definitely.
Simply because you believe it, and simply because you want this, you have the capability to change your entire environment around you whenever you want. It may not be as dramatic as being able to fly through the air, but that is the basis of spellcraft. That is what magic is, the art and science of causing change to occur in conformity with will means. It means that as long as you believe and as long as you take actions appropriate to changing your life, you are going to succeed, period.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the whole premise behind a lot of occult traditions, is the development of willpower strong enough to override your natural tendencies and habits. Mm. And, I mean, okay, we're not even going to, like, relate these to the cards, because I'm not even sure how to do that, because we tend to do that tangent kind of thing, and I love that. but, like, when you're first learning to, like, meditate, for instance, you start very restless and unable to control your thoughts, and you get uncomfortable with the position you're sitting in, you know, and you get, like, really antsy and, you know, irritable and that sort of thing. So, I mean, essentially what you do in that, as you learn to meditate and get better at it, is you're developing your willpower, right? And it's the same ability that you have in order to make use of spellcraft, meditation, anything that, you know, we tend to associate with New Age or magic or the occult in general, is the ability to develop your own willpower. And I think in actual fact that I can relate that to the Five of Pentacles, because again, it's a matter of willing yourself past the grief sense, past that unwillingness to, you know, act, you know, breaking the habit of self-pity and wallowing that stagnates your progress, right? Mm-hmm.
And another one I just thought of, in Star Wars, the Phantom Menace, when Qui-Gon is talking to Anakin at one point on Coruscant, he says to him, "Your focus determines your reality." And that smacked me like a big old herring right upside the head, straight out of Monty Python. I was gobsmacked when I heard that the first time, because that is so true. What you focus on determines your reality, which relates right back to the Five of Cups.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, another way of putting the same thought is energy goes where attention flows, or energy flows where attention goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically it's a matter of choosing to look beyond your current situation at what's possible following it.
Mm-hmm. And everybody who does any kind of magic or any kind of path working or anything along those lines should have that capability, should be able to do that. Even Wiccans, even if you don't do magic, even if you don't do spells, even if you don't do the votive offerings to your deities to ask them for favors, you should still be able to look down into the future a few days and be able to reason out the consequences of actions that you take now. If only because the Reed and the Law of Three force you to. I mean, the Reed says, "And at harm none, do as you will." Okay, everybody knows that. That's the one thing that seems that everybody knows. But what that actually means is, as long as it doesn't harm anybody, do what you want to do. Okay, if your action's not going to harm anybody, do it. With the converse being, if your action is going to be harmful to others, consider what you're doing first. And as long as you're willing to pay the consequences of that action and take responsibility and own those consequences, do it if that's what you feel necessary to do. Okay? That's what a lot of the fluff bunnies and a lot of the one book and I'm a witch Wiccans don't get. They hear, "Don't harm anybody," and that's it. And they think that's the sum total of it. It's not. It's, as long as nobody's going to get harmed, do it, but consider your actions. Well, this means that you're going to have to reason out a consequence tree. You're going to have to say, okay, if I spend this money right now on this item that I don't really need, what could happen? Well, you're not going to have that money, obviously, which means that you may not be able to pay your bills, which means that whatever bill doesn't get paid, it's possible that that service is going to stop or you're going to be hungry. And that means, and that means, and that means, and that means. And this is a skill you have to have as a as somebody who does spells, as somebody who works with astral beings, as anybody who sends out energy into the universe to pull something to you. You have to be able to reason out those consequence trees in order to either mitigate the results to make them least harmful as possible, or to go, okay, I am willing to accept the consequences of this action, and I'm willing to pay that price to get this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's something important that we all have to learn, even just dealing with people day to day. I mean, you have to be able to see the consequences of each potential action in order to make the correct choice, because it's not necessarily a matter of right and wrong, but rather what is best for the greater good. And that's not always what people would consider the right choice.
And I tend not to, personally, I'm a pragmatist magician. I go with the theory that if it works, do it. So I'm not always worrying about the greater good, because let's face it, we're selfish beings. We focus on ourselves mostly first. And we tend to think of what's good for us is good for everybody. Well, as long as you're willing to go, okay, I'm going to do this for me, and there's going to be repercussions to the people around me, is this really what I want? Is my instant self-gratification here more important than what's going to happen to those around us? You know, and That's me. That's how I tend to operate. And for the most part, as long as I'm cognizant of those consequences and either ready to accept them or ready to say, okay, that's too high a price to pay for what I want and stop that action, it seems to work out pretty okay. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with being selfish, really, because everything that you do ultimately is going to affect you and nobody but you. You are the one constant in your life. Nobody else is. So you might as well live it for you and do what you want throughout your life to be happy. You know, and this is not let's be irresponsible, let's go out and let's do, you know, drugs and have sex with everybody that walks around. This is nothing of the sort. This is a self-enlightened selfishness. It's enlightened self-interest, period. You know, as long as you're ready to, like I said, pay those consequences or stop what you're trying to do because the consequences are too high, I say do it because, I mean, you're making the future 1 second at a time now, and the only person that's going to be living in that future is you.
Exactly. I mean, I actually tend to be, like, when I was doing spellcraft and that sort of thing, I was the type who very strongly believed that if you couldn't, in general principle, if you can't curse, then you can't do positive magic. Like, if you're mentally hindering yourself from being able to do what is necessary to achieve the things that are going to help you without destroying everyone else, then you're holding yourself back, and there's no real point in you practicing spellcraft of any kind. I mean, you might as well just flip a coin and make wishes or something. because you're basically tossing your hands up in the air and saying, you know what, I don't want to take responsibility for my own choices. I don't want to practice spellcraft if
it's going to be dark and scary and icky.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I've always been drawn really strongly to the sort of darker side of magic, not in the sense of what people tend to term black magic, as much as kind of getting in tune with like the shadow side of the psyche. Mm-hmm. Because I think personally that I've always felt there's almost an obsessive focus on positivity and light and, you know, all this kind of stuff among spiritually inclined people, particularly, and I speak as a former Wiccan myself, but there's a lot of Wiccans out there who are really love and light, and, you know, there's no way that, you know, anything negative could possibly happen if we constantly think positively about each other and so on. But the reality is, there is no light without darkness, and if you deny one versus the other, then you're just being ridiculous. Actually,
speaking to the choir, because I agree with everything that you're saying. I mean, we were talking about this on Tumblr not too long ago. It is only when you have boots. Stop that. He's trying to sharpen her claws on our furniture. Anyway, without having a dark, or let's just take sunlight here. Sunlight casts a shadow. Well, if you take away the sunlight, there is no shadow, but there's also no light. You have nothing at that point. So exactly. It's only in having both that you're going to see the difference. You're not going to understand what happy is unless you've been sad. There's just no way that you can conceive of happiness and joy and ecstasy without being sad and depressed and hurt, okay? And with, you know, doing negative magic, just because you know how to doesn't mean you have to. That's one of the things that just boggles my mind, is that there's all these people out there that are going, oh, I only do good magic. I only want to do magic to help myself and help my friends and help my family. I'm not going to hurt anybody. I'm not going to curse anybody. That's fine. You don't have to. But what you need to do is you need to understand how those curses work. You need to understand what's involved with them so that, first off, you can avoid it if that's what you truly want to do. And second off, you can defend against it when it's coming at you. And third off, so that you can recognize it when it does start happening.
That's funny, because now it makes me think to Harry Potter and Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Granted, it is.
If
but
you don't study the so-called dark arts, then you won't have any idea of what they can do. You know, and in that sense, you're actually kind of limiting your own knowledge, your own ability to learn new things. Like, one of the things that I used to do a lot when I was a kid was to play with poppets. I'm not even going to, you know, pervert them by calling them voodoo dolls, but they're like stuffed or, you know, wax or whatever human figures that you cast spells on, mm-hmm. and they represent someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that for me was something that I found really appealing, you know, and the potential of being able to use those actually came in quite handy back in the early 2000s when I was house sitting for this woman and tending to her horses. And she had this son who was like obnoxious and miserable, and he would come back to the place like from, you know, wherever the hell he would go, and all he wanted to do was fight and be miserable and horrible at people, and he would just treat everyone like shit, like he owned the place. And so what I decided one day was just that I was fed up with him because he was obnoxious and rude, and he was a dick, basically.
He was being a kid, in other words.
Well, he was 19, right? But he was such a spoiled shit, right? Who who just felt like, you know, everyone owed him something because...
Oh, God, the entitled...
Oh, God, you have no idea. I mean, he came from an educational system that adapted specifically for him. They gave him, like, double graduating credit on Pottery 12 or something like that because he wasn't mentally capable of functioning in any of the other, like, basic grade 12 courses. So they credited him twice on pottery. It was just ridiculous. I mean, he was a dick. So what I did one day was I harvested some of the candle stubs that he'd been using, you know, on his sojourns around the house when he did come around. I think he actually was using them to light up his joints or something. But anyway, he had all these candle stubs lying around, so I decided I'd collect them. And then he had, like, an old pair of shoes sitting around, so I snipped off a bit of the laces, and I pulled some hair out of one of his brushes, because he had, like, 12 of them around his fucking room. And so I basically melted the candles and created a poppet and named it after him, and then, like, tossed it onto a bonfire with some ad-libbed words, basically trying to send him away, because he was just pissing me off all the time. And it worked. I mean, within, like, a week, he was gone completely. Like, he'd moved to the coast or something, and he was living with his brother or some such. Except that the friend that he had, who would come around and visit us, also disappeared, because apparently the shoes that he bought, like, that I had snipped the laces from, were his, that the son had just sort of adopted as his own. And I was like, well, shit, you know, like, the nice guy, you know, got sent away too. And I was like, fuck, I'm proud of this, you know, success, but at the same time, I'm like, that had an entirely unseen consequence, and I was just like, oh, crap.
That's one of the basic magical laws of the universe that you just rediscovered, the law of unintended consequences. No matter how you hedge it, there's always going to be a consequence that you can't foresee. You just have to get used to it, and you have to accept it, and you have to learn to think quick and try to fix it before it gets out of hand.
Yeah. At the same time, it was a lesson well learned, you know, that I still had what I needed to do, you know, if I wanted to cast spells at random. Because, I mean, it had been years since I had cast a spell at this point, and I was just, I can't handle him, so I'm going to try this and see if it works.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you did a good thing. You didn't wish harm on him. You didn't, you know, want him to die or anything like that. And, I mean, what little kid hasn't looked at their parents and gone, I wish you would die, you know? That's a spell, too. It's just that the child doesn't have enough emotional energy at that point or the knowledge to channel it properly. It's kind of like using a squirt gun when you could be using a laser beam. And you were mentioning poppets. Kumiko, if you don't stop clawing the chair... you were mentioning poppets, and I remembered something. One, I found a use for all those corn dollies you make at both Mabon and Imbolc, with Bridget. You know, because you make them, that's one of the activities, is you do that, and you put them around, you play with them for a little while, you maybe put them on your altar, you know, and then that's it. And then you've got, you know, 20 corn dollies. What do you do with them? Well, I found out that you can repurpose those into poppets.
That makes sense.
Yes, it does. You can take them because they're not set for anybody specifically. You can draw whatever astrological symbols or whatever symbols you need to on there to dedicate them to people, to specific people. And you've got a perfect poppet. It's already made. It doesn't have to be stuffed. It doesn't, you know, if you need a spell right now, you can just go into your supply cabinet, pull it out, draw a couple of runes on it, and, you know, rededicate it and burn it or chop it up into little pieces or whatever, you know.
And it's biodegradable, too. So it's environmentally responsible. We've turned it into a PSA. That's right.
Recycle your poppets.
I think everyone should. I mean, you're going to make the damn things. You might as well use them in more than one way.
Mm-hmm. And that struck me with because my daughter had made like 3 or 4, and we were displaying them around the house, you know, and it would, had been a couple of weeks since they had been made, and, you know, something happened, and they got knocked off, and they started getting underfoot and started falling apart, and it's like I picked it up after a month or so, and I'm like, what the hell are we going to do with these? And then it went, oh, that's a good poppet, you know? Hey. So I collected them all up, stuck them in a bag, and threw them in the chest that we use as an altar, and what I need when I pull it out. So that's pretty cool. And don't forget that, you know, you can use poppets not just for cursing magic. You can use them for healing magic, too. You can use them for blessing magic. And that's the origin of the voodoo dolls. It's not just stick a pin in there so that the other person hurts. What it was it was an effigy of a deity that had areas where you could insert a clay pin, if you will. It had pre-drilled holes, and you slid it in there to tell your deity or the Loa or whatever the deities were, are over in Africa where, you know, you needed healing at. And that was how they communicated it with this particular god form, and that's how they got healing for it. Well, when it migrated over into the Caribbean and with the slaves and everything, and then the white man saw it, and they perverted it, and they changed it, and they, you know, built up legends around it, and now it's used as a cursing tool. But that's not where it originally came from. It was a healing tool. It was something to say to the deities, okay, this is an aspect in my life, in me, that I need help with. So I'm going to put this pin into a hole on the head, showing that I need knowledge. Educate me, please. You know, and then you get extra lessons, you get homework, you get, you know, more chances to study, to go to school, whatever. But it was a way of, you know, bringing other things into your life. It wasn't just cursing.
Yeah, definitely. Basically, I mean, poppets and voodoo dolls and that sort of thing are one form of sympathetic magic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's tons of... Okay, I'm not going to say there's tons, because I don't know a lot of them that touch on it much anymore. But if you look at Raymond Buckland's Big Blue Book, it's called The Complete Book of Witchcraft, I think.
Yes.
He talks about it in one lesson, about the origin of sympathetic magic and that sort of thing. And if you happen to be really into it, not a lot of people are really into it, but who the hell is it? Fraser.
The thing about, Ray Buckland is, okay, let me get this out of the way. I'm Sayaks Wiccan. My first book on witchcraft that was actually dedicated to Wicca or witchcraft was the Big Blue Book, okay? So I am a big fan of Ray's. I have met him. I've talked to him. He's a great guy. He's the founder of my tradition of Wicca. So I've got a lot of respect for the man. That said, the Big Blue Book was the... In the book, as you read it through, he talks about the Sayaks Wiccan Seminary, which is an educational program that was developed for teaching the... clergy of the Sayaks Wicca tradition how to be good priests and priestesses. Well, the Big Blue Book, according to him, and this is in private conversations that I've had with him, the Big Blue Book is that seminary course genericized. Okay? He took out specific tradition, specific rituals and items, and made it a pan-pagan ritual instead, but this is the same material that was mailed out to the clergy of the Sayaks Wiccan tradition. It is an excellent, excellent starting point. Okay.
Yeah, it really is. I mean,
that stated, it is also very, very dated. He came out with a revision of it here recently, within the past 10 years, I think, and it's, you know, still the same good book. I was a little upset that he didn't take the opportunity to update some of the outdated information, some of the false mythology that's been built up. But as long as you keep in mind, this is a starting point. This is not the be-all, end-all. There are multiple books, something like 180 other books, referenced in the Big Blue Book. And he even says in there, if you read through this book and read every single referenced book, you will have an education equivalent to a third-degree Wiccan Gardnerian priestess. And you will, because things are referenced in there like the Golden Bough, the
That's
White Goddess.
That's the book I'm thinking of. That one talks about sympathetic magic and other things as well. Brilliant book, but it's not for everyone.
Oh, no. The Golden Bough is about as thick as the Mabinogion. Okay, it is a huge book. It is in multiple volumes, and it is been used as a basic college-level course in religions and mythology multiple times. Okay, this is not something for beginners, but it's something that will give you an extremely thorough education on Hellenistic religion. It's the Iliad, the Odyssey, all the Bullfinch's mythologies, Edith Hamilton's mythologies, and like 20 other mythology books all rolled into one. Okay.
It really is pretty awesome.
It is. Great.
But again, don't feel that you have to like read all the big heavy books. Get a couple of the really beginner type books, because as you get more and more knowledgeable, what you're going to find is that there are a lot of books. A lot of the older ones are more fans of that, but there's what I call the pop history of Wicca, and then there's like the actual history of Wicca.
Yeah.
You're going to hear a lot of the pop history, which is, you know, it dates back in an unbroken line for tens of thousands of years.
Well, that's what they wanted to believe. And, you know, given the fact, I'm not going to dismiss the mythological history or the pop history completely, because there's a grain of truth in it. The traditions of sympathetic magic, which is a huge part of Wicca, the traditions of worshiping divinities that are not Yahweh and not of the Bible, the traditions of healing with herbs, and the traditions of believing in something greater than yourself do date back millennia.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
sure.
You can't look at the sky and see all the stars there and then watch a cloud roll in and suddenly it's raining and lightning is coming down and not think that there's something greater than yourself. I mean, that's human nature. Okay? So in that, that's true. Now, some of the people, and I can name one or two authors right off the top of my head here. Who perpetuate this myth of what we practice now in Wicca is exactly what was practiced 10,000 years ago, identical, you know, is bullshit. And I'm not going to leaven at all, because it is. And
it really is. I mean, the simple truth is, there are elements of medieval ritual magic that have entered Wicca. There are aspects...
Elements because they were deliberately put there by Gardner. I mean, when he's studying this and he's learning from the cunning men and women and the horse whisperers and the herb wives and the midwives that are in England, and he incorporates their knowledge into Wicca, of course it's going to be there.
Yeah, definitely.
He's doing this deliberately. He wants it there. He was encouraging people from various outlying areas who were what he referred to as cunning men and women to come and join Wicca. And they would get, when it was new, and they would join and they would sit there, you know, and they would be grinning because, you know, they have all of this esoteric knowledge. you know, and they wouldn't say very much of anything. And everybody thought that they were so, you know, wonderful and knowledgeable and, you know, holy and whatever because they didn't say anything. Me, if it were me, I'd just be sitting there going, yeah, I'm wise. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Well,
yeah. Honor me.
The interesting thing, I think, is that there are people who speculate that the coven that Gardner trained with, I think it's called the New Forest Coven.
Yes, it was.
Is actually, it was a group of, like, pseudo-theosophists.
Yeah,
and
kind of a lodge-like thing.
And if you look at, like, things like Alice Bailey's books or Madame Blavatsky's books, you're going to find a lot of those ideas have sort of seeped into what we now call Wicca.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I mean, that's kind of where you find... okay, now we're veering into other aspects of New Age spirituality because I can. There's actually, like, a channel on YouTube called Spirit Science, I believe it is, has some fantastic videos. I have to give the guy credit for making cutesy cartoons that are really informative. But he draws really heavily from Dronvallo Melchizedek's Secrets of the Flower of Life, Volumes 1 and 2. Now, I was having a discussion with a friend a couple of months ago, and I had pointed out that a lot of what's in the Flower of Life books is actually kind of repeated information from Blavatsky, Bailey, you know, and all these other pre-existing occultists, I guess you could call them.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, my point was that there's nothing wrong with the fact that the information is passed along, but you can't take the credit for it like it's brand new. My friend said, well, what does it matter? I mean, the information is still true, so who cares where it came from or, you know, how old it is or whatever. And I said, but the point was, if you're going to claim the information, at least credit its sources.
Go ahead. Okay. That's really important, is to, yeah, credit your sources. But there's a converse side to that, too, wherein you're studying alone. You haven't been exposed to Alice Bailey. You haven't been exposed to Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society. You haven't read their things. You haven't read anything from the OTO or the Golden Dawn. And you, through your own practice, come upon a concept that just blows your mind away, okay? And you write it down and claim it as brand new knowledge. Well, here's the thing. If it's already written down in somebody else's book and you claim it as your own, that's great. That's fine. At least have the courage to say, okay, I was unaware of this material. I discovered it when I was doing this, 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 and this. But if you want another take on this same subject, I've been told that this reference and this reference have a lot to do with what I rediscovered. Have the courage to at least say that. Don't get all defensive. Don't get all upset. Don't get all high and mighty because somebody says, oh, well, Blavatsky found that, you know, 2 centuries ago when she was doing her thing, and you're saying this is brand new information. You know, if you're unaware of it, that's fine. But when it's pointed out, at least, you know, have the intestinal fortitude to stand up and say, okay, I didn't know about this. I thought I was rediscovering something. Here's how I discovered it. But if you want more information, go here, look at this too, because they're saying the same thing.
You know what I think is funny? We've turned this into tarot and Wicca lessons. And you know what? I think we should carry it on, because actually I was thinking, you know, a while back of doing Witching Hour on Wednesdays. So we would talk about exactly that kind of thing. And I think this is a good thing. You know, we talk about the tarot first hour, and we talk about Wicca the second, you know, and we relate all kinds of crazy, you know, stories and research and experiences, and it makes it a very full couple of hours that people will enjoy.
The thing, I really don't want to turn this into another Wiccan podcast. I am glad that we do have the opportunity to talk more about other aspects, because ultimately, when you're dealing with the other worlds and the aethers and deities and thought forms and angels and guides and teachers and indigo children and dragons and fairies and whatever else is out there, it all ties together. Okay, the concepts in the tarot, expressed in the major arcana, the situations that are shown in the minor arcana, are the same situations that you're going to get on the astral plane. They're the same situations that you're going to find yourself dealing with in your mundane life. They're the same situations that you're going to deal with in your spiritual life as well. I mean, yeah, the Five of Pentacles represents poverty, okay? It can represent the loss of a job, but just as much is it can represent a loss of faith. Because, I mean, there's a church in the background, and these two people are outside of it. Well, that means that they're either not part of the church, or they've been cast out of the church, or they're just not, you know, comfortable enough going into the church. And it could be that they're not part of the brotherhood to be able to take advantage of the resources of that church.
Or it could be a similar situation to what I experienced, where they were involved for years, and through the slip of irrelevant information, suddenly everyone decided, oh, well, you can't be part of our group because you're wrong.
Cast out and exiled, yeah.
Oh,
and,
God.
You know,
anyway.
These situations are going to crop up in any type of life you care to name. I have had situations. My cards tend to read on a spiritual level for people. They tell you about your spiritual life. They tell you about your faith. They tell you about the gods around you, because I tend to be focused on that in my regular life. But just as much, I've also seen it in my financial situations in my financial life, situations in my love life, situations in my interactions with other world beings, situations like this on the internet and on the phone, where I'm teaching somebody. You know, so any type of situation you're going to see come up in the cards. That's what these are for. So it all interrelates. I mean, no information is ever lost or ever useless. You know, just because you know how to cast a curse doesn't mean that you have to. But it helps to know how to cast a curse, how to hex somebody, how to harm them. I mean, here's another example. A surgeon literally goes in and harms you to make you better. I mean, it is not a natural act to take a knife and slice open a body. It just is not. So a surgeon will deliberately cut you open to take out something else so that you can get better. That's their job. They are, but they're considered healers. And they're, you know, celebrated people all over. You never hear anybody talking about how great the general practitioner is or the family practitioner, but you see dramas on TV all the time about the surgeons. Well, the surgeons fucking hurt you. And pardon
That's
my
true.
French, but they do.
That's very true, actually.
You know?
I never thought about it, but that does actually make a really good point. I mean, the simple truth is, the polarity exists because that's just how it is. I mean, there's no escaping that. The tarot is going to tell you the same thing. I mean, every situation has some element where it's negative to you, but it may actually turn out better for you in the end.
This hurts you more than it hurts me. How many
exactly.
people have heard that?
Oh.
I know I did. Okay. getting back to the tarot, because we've got about 23 minutes left, one thing that I did want to talk about, and I mentioned it to Brian before the show started, he was mentioning something about old tarot decks. And I realized that I hadn't spoken yet about what to do with an old tarot deck. There's a lot of things that you can do. First off, you can keep using it. But as we all know, when you use cards too much, oil on your hands, dirt in the environment, the coffee that you spilled on your table and didn't wipe up completely, that then dried and is now sticky, they get on your cards and they cause problems. Some of that is good, and that's going to happen. It's a natural progression. Some of it is bad, and there's going to come a time when your cards just aren't shuffling right. They're coming out in clumps because they're sticking together. There's a few things that you can do. First off, there's a product out on the internet called Card Slick. At least I believe that's what it's called, but that's the general idea. It's a powder. You take your tarot deck, you put it in a paper bag, you squirt some of this card slick in there, you roll down the top of the paper bag, and you shake it really, really good. Okay? And what this does is this is a powder that coats the individual cards so that they act like they're new again. They slide across each other. It's either some kind of graphite that's extremely fine ground, or most likely a talc of some sort, like Johnson's baby powder, where you can use it to, at least for a little bit, refurbish your cards. And believe me, this stuff works really well. When I was going to the Mormon seminary, when I was a Mormon back when I was a teenager, one of the tricks that we used to turn to certain passages was we would open the Bible to that passage, we would highlight it, and then we would squirt some baby powder in there and smear it all over the pages. Well, when you're opening the book after that, it's going to naturally fall to those pages with the baby powder on it, simply due to the fact that that reduces friction so much that if you just push on the edge of the pages, and those Bible pages are so thin anyway, they're like onion skin, it just falls open to those pages because there's less friction there. Same thing with the cards and the card slick. It coats the individual cards and allows them to move over each other a lot easier, kind of like graphite or something along those lines. Don't use any kind of lubricating oil or lotion or anything like that. That will ruin them completely. You'll have to just drop them into your cauldron and your bonfire, because after that they're useless. You can do that. You can save that deck also for use in magic spells. Like we've been talking about, like I've been talking about occasionally with the book called Tarot Spells, there's times when you have the tarot cards and you use them and the symbols on them as part of your spell work. You look through your deck, you find the specific cards you need, you lay them out, you move them around, you play war with them if you want, but it's kind of like using them, the cards, as the representations of what you want to bring into your life. You want to bring money into your life, you want to hang on to it, pull out the Four of Coins, and pull out a significator for you, and through the course of the spell work, move it slowly closer to each other to bring that money into your life, so forth and so on. That's another use you can use for old tarot decks. And it's a lot better than just tossing them in the trash. Go ahead.
Sorry. I think, too, that if you have an old tarot deck that you no longer want, if you have, like, friends who have a kid who's kind of curious about tarot, if that deck vibes with the kid, pass it on. You know, like, they're going to learn the symbols from these cards regardless of whether they can use them as well as an experienced tarot reader would. But they at least provide, a resource for the symbolism and stuff while they're learning.
Mm-hmm. And do that with the parents' permission if they're underage. You know, most people are going to know a 5-year-old is going to be attracted to the pretty things. They're going to see this different stuff. You can educate them about it. The parents do need to be participant in that. But an 18-year-old, probably you can go without the parental permission.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
If the kid belongs to a Jehovah's Witness family or something, you might want to not even consider bringing up the fact that you have tarot cards at all.
But the advice that I was given were more for decks that you've used them for 5 or 6 years. They're all sticky and they're not shuffled. They're worn out.
They're like frayed at the edges. And
yeah, it's time to go throw them in the trash and buy a new deck. Don't throw them in the trash. another thing that Brian mentioned earlier is that you can use them as artwork around the house. There's nothing wrong with getting a series of small frames, putting 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or however many you can fit in there into a frame and displaying it on your wall. If you want to use it as a training aid, you can glue them to paper cards and use them as flashcards for training your children or somebody in your coven or something along those lines.
Or if you're a writer and are experiencing writer's block, you can use those as stimulation for your creativity.
Yes, most definitely. Last thing is if they're absolutely unsalvageable, big gaping rips, falling apart, it's either, throw them away and get a new deck or, you can't read with these anymore. Instead of actually throwing them in the trash. Because here's the thing. You've spent, we'll say a decade, getting to know these cards, these specific cards, not just the deck, not the artist and the artwork and the way it was drawn, but this specific deck. You have spent time putting your energy into it, pulling the card's energy out into you so that it reads for you and so that you can interpret it in a reading. Throwing it in the trash is like going and dropping a baby off in a dumpster. At least to me it would be. It would be, I've rewritten my Book of Shadows and I no longer need this copy that I hand wrote from my priestess and that I've been using for the last 5 years. I'm just going to drop it in the recycle bin. I can't think of a larger sacrilege. I really can't, and disrespect to the concept of the cards, because the cards are going to have a personality of their own. So treat them with that respect. You wouldn't drop Grandpa off in the recycle bin when he dies. So don't do that with your cards. My suggestion would be is if they're irredeemable and you can't use them for anything else and you can't recycle them and you can't use them in another fashion like this, the next Beltania fire that you have, sacrifice them in there. It not only gets rid of them, it's a choice offering for the gods. It is respectful to the cards themselves because they get to give of themselves one more time. It destroys the deck so other people can't use it, because here's something else. If you drop your deck of cards into a trash bin and Joe Blow out there that doesn't know anything but has a lot of psychic potential picks them up and starts playing with them, he's going to be pulling your energy off of those cards. Your energy is infused into those cards, and so you need to be cautious of who has that energy when you no longer have them in your possession. It's one of the reasons that a lot of readers don't let people play with their cards or shuffle their cards or even touch their cards. Okay? Because that other person can start pulling that energy off, and that energy, having been part of you, can be used as sympathetic magic to get through your protections to you. So you want to be cognizant of that. You want to deny that opportunity to people that might have malevolent attitudes toward you, or even people who are indifferent to you, who might just be, oh, I don't care about Susie, the witch there, but she is a witch, and because she's a witch, this is a witch's tool, and this is a horrible thing, and so I'm going to stab it with a knife. Well, if your energy's part of that, you're going to suffer for that. You know, if they believe hard enough, that's just part and parcel of it. So sacrificing it in a bonfire, you know, saying, Lord and Lady, you know, here are my tarot cards. They've served me well. Thank you for sending them to me. They're my children. Take care of them. Here, would you please have them? Is a perfect ending for them, in my opinion. It's respectful. It's recyclable. It's considerate. It's kind. It prevents others from using your energy against you.
Definitely. Anyway.
So that's what I got.
You don't even have to do it in a huge public fashion either. Like, you don't have to do it at a festival. You can, if you feel that it's something that you personally want to, you know, say your goodbyes to, then, I mean, it sounds really horrible, but you can always, like, use your barbecue. or, you know, if you happen to have a chiminera,
I want one.
So do I. I think they're great.
$300 for it, though. It's a little pricey.
I know. I mean, they're so nice, though. But, you know, I mean, there's nothing stopping you from coming up with your own way of saying goodbye to these cards.
Oh, yeah.
And
any ritual tool is like that. You don't want to just throw it away or snap it or whatever. I mean, I would think that it would be really hard to, you know, melt down an Athame, but you could always, you know, I guess de-sanctify it and use it for chopping your herbs up for other tools.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely other ways to use various tools. And I was thinking about wands, because I've been really wanting to make myself a wand. Now, I don't know, personally, I think I like the idea of what used to happen with certain diviners and craftsmen and, you know, that sort of thing in, like, the Iron Age, where a person had these tools, you know, and worked with them and had them buried with them. I actually wrote, like, a little tiny sort of funerary service based on a poem that I found in a book that I own, where basically, following the little poem, you were throwing different items into the grave with the person.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, at some point, asks for a staff or wisdom or something like that. And then my suggestion was to throw a wand or staff into the grave with that person.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, if a person's used those tools for their entire life, or, you know, even a significant portion of their life, it may do you well just to save it until, you know, they finally say goodbye to this particular physical shell and move on into their next manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good idea, too. It's something that I hadn't thought of, and I bet a lot of green burial advocates haven't thought of about either. But, you know, it would certainly make sense with the traditions for pagan festivals and pagan burials, because Lord and Lady know that there were enough people that got buried with their possessions and slaves and cats and hunting dogs and bows and arrows and boats and chariots and war horses when they died. So, you know, it would make sense that if, you know, a blacksmith master craftsman died, that, you know, his forged tools would go with him so that he could continue his craft in the other worlds.
Exactly.
You know, and that would make sense for us too. And that's actually a very, very good thought, something that I hadn't considered. Wonder if that would apply to when cats die for burying their laser pointers with them.
I think so.
Probably.
I think you should. I'm sure cats would appreciate that, especially a mummified cat. It's going to need something to keep itself busy. And I think that flows very well with the Egyptian tradition entirely.
Yes, it does. And as I pointed out on Tumblr the other night, it's proof that the Internet is actually ancient Egypt because we write on people's walls and we all worship cats. And so,
very true. This is very true.
Oh, it is. So anyway, okay, let me see. So tarot cards and storage. I'm an advocate of keeping the tarot cards when you buy them in the box that they came with, along with a little pamphlet. Because there are times when I've been out and I've needed to refresh my memory on what a specific card means, and I've turned to a little pamphlet, and it's given me just enough to refresh my memory so that I don't look like an idiot.
True.
That's hard to do.
Keep the little booklet when you buy a deck. Do not get rid of that. It will help you immensely when you need it.
Oh, yes. And it makes a great place to also write the deck's tarot dedication on. And there's going to be usually a cover card and another card on the very back that aren't part of the tarot deck, kind of like the jokers in a writer back deck of playing cards.
Yeah.
You don't use them; you set them aside, but they make very good covers for the deck. You put the top card face down on a deck, and you put the other one on the backside so that, you know, if there's movement inside of the box or whatever, the cards themselves aren't getting damaged by that. But the card box makes a good way to store the cards. And then from there, you can, you know, figure out ways to transport it. I've got my physical deck. I've got two physical decks that I use all the time, the Celtic deck and the Robin Wood deck. The Robin Wood deck, I have a leather pouch that I made for it, and I wrap it up in a silk handkerchief that has a lot of Japanese artwork and ideographs on it that my mother gave me. And that, you know, is wonderful for it. The Celtic tarot I put in a tic-tac box, believe it or not. It's a really, really big tic-tac box. It had like 200 tic-tacs in it or something. But it's a hard plastic box, and it protects the deck. And that's how I carry it around in my purse when I'm using that. You know, so
obviously, tic-tac was made for witches.
Apparently. Something. Anyway, think about those types of things. What you're going to want to think about is not only protection for the deck, but also insulation. As you move around during the day, you're going to come into contact with a lot of other people. Their energies are going to interact with yours. It's one reason why when you get up early in the morning and take a shower, you feel wonderful, and then you slowly get more and more depressed and upset as the day goes on. It's not just that your energy is wearing out, it's that other people's spiritual energies are rubbing off onto you. And then you take a shower and you feel better again because you've washed it all off. Well, your deck is attuned to picking up energy. That's what it's supposed to do. So as you go around and you've got your deck in your purse and you bump into Joe Blow Gangsta on the street who's listening to his rap music, who might be depressed, who might cut, who might be suicidal, it's going to pick up that energy unless it's insulated. And the only ways that I know to insulate it are with either silk or with plastic. You could do it with glass, too, but it would have to be a really, really thick box, and then it would be, you know, almost
heavy,
unwieldy.
Clumsy.
Oh, yeah. And it would be fragile if it were thin enough not to be heavy. But with a plastic box, one of the options that I thought of was the travel soap boxes for the full-size bars. Those are almost perfect for putting a tarot deck in. They're about the right size. A plastic cigarette box, too, because I used to smoke. I used to get those boxes at the cigarette stores, and you could fit a standard-size tarot deck in there very easily. And yes, you could. It protects the deck. It insulates it. It keeps it from getting, you know, damaged and scattered and turned around, and then it's right there to pull them out, shuffle them, you're ready to go. It looks strange as heck, and I'm sure that if you were at a convention or a psychic fair and you reached down into your bag and pulled out this plastic cigarette box and opened it up and pulled out a deck of cards and started shuffling it, people would be giving you very strange looks. But hey, I'm a pragmatist. What works, works.
Besides, you shouldn't spend a fortune on a storage container for the cards if it's not, you know, in your bank account to do so.
Or unless directed to by somebody else, such as your deities or the deck themselves. If you're going to use this deck only for reading in a ritual or for reading at a festival or for your pagan brothers and sisters, then yes, have a special box for it. Keep it in your altar with your altar items and your other tools. Pull it out for those special occasions. Use it then, no problem. But if you're going to have a deck that you're going to carry around with you during the day, during the week, for emergency readings, for one-card-a-day readings, three-card what's-going-on readings, then you're going to want something that's going to protect it, be a little bit more hardy, and be, you know, reasonable. And most of all, you know, deniability as well. You know, the opaque plastic cigarette boxes like I was talking about, you can't see through them, so somebody sees it in your bag, and they're like, oh, okay, well, cigarettes. Never see you smoke, but okay. You know,
exactly.
If they're, you know, if they're a huge, you know, Christian, and they look in there and they see Rider Waite tarot deck, they're, oh, demon! You know.
It's true.
Liability and stealth witchcraft.
10 seconds left. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Thank you. See you guys next week, same time. We're talking about the sixes and a couple of other cards.
Next two cards.
Good night, folks.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.